Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Armed with actual facts and a sharp eye, Jennifer Briney hosts a podcast called Congressional Dish. She actually watches all of the congressional hearings that matter, and she analyzes the bills that they pass. And it leads her to stark, stark conclusions. Today, you'll find out how reading the National Defense Authorization Act informed her view of the U.S. role in the coup in Ukraine in 2014 and our ambitions to launch a new Cold War. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions at peterbcollins.com. And today we dedicate this podcast to John Zweibel, a very generous supporter of this podcast, both financially and intellectually. And as you'll hear, he helped provoke my decision to invite Jen Briney back on the podcast today. If you'd like to subscribe, visit peterbcollins.com. Click menu, then click become a subscriber, and you'll be on the sign-up page where it's pretty easy to figure out. Thanks for listening. Jennifer Briney hosts the powerful podcast Congressional Dish. And by looking at the bills that Congress writes, she's come face-to-face with America's war machine. That's some protest rock circa 1970 from the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives, and yes, I do deduct. It's called Monster by Steppenwolf, and it's a politically themed song that is as relevant today as it was in the era of Richard Nixon. And it's a favorite tune of John Zweibel, and he's one of the people who inspired today's podcast. I want to put the blame there front and center. Jen Briney, welcome back to the PBC podcast.
Thank you for having me back. It's good to see you again.
You are doing amazing work at Congressional Dish.
That's very nice of you to say. Thank you.
I've listened to your last two episodes, and I was just floored because you have forensically built a case based on the National Defense Authorization Act about the U.S. involvement in the coup in Ukraine in 2014. And about the intentions of the Trump administration vis-a-vis nuclear weapons and war plans for the future. And you tell me that it's causing you to lose sleep at night.
It is. I haven't slept very well for about 2 weeks now. Just because I'm reading about this stuff and it's so different from what we're seeing on the television. Mm-hmm. And that juxtaposition of, like, I'm paying attention to nuclear weapons while other people are not. And I'm having a lot of trouble dealing with this in a way that I haven't in the past. It's just so different. I mean, for those, most people probably haven't heard the podcast. So what's really affecting me is I'm watching them put in black and white that we're restarting the Cold War.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us have the feeling that that's happening, but they are doing it. And mm-hmm. You can hear them discussing now how ISIS is a thing of the past. I just don't understand how they go from ISIS is metastasizing, it's a cancer that's everywhere, and now it's over.
Well,
and
Russia, now it's all about Russia.
Yeah. And it's a really dangerous game they're playing. And And their way of dealing with Russia is we're going to replace pretty much our entire nuclear weapons infrastructure. And it's just not anything that people are aware of. And it's been going on for a while, too.
Well, you point out in the podcast that the whole nuclear review began under Obama.
It did.
And he's a guy who came into office talking about, just like other presidents have, trying to wind down our nuclear arsenal and ultimately reach a nuclear-free world. And instead, he put the wheels in motion to rebuild our nuclear infrastructure from ground up. And Trump is essentially expanding on that.
Yeah. And that was really disappointing to me. It was disappointing to me that I didn't catch that during the Obama administration. So to know that this plan has been in motion for a while now. But just to see how the Trump is expanding it, they're going to do two new programs. And they're also going to redo the infrastructure that we let disappear that would let us create new nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So they're starting us on the path of creating more nuclear weapons instead of eliminating them. And it's such a huge decision that I feel like the American public has not been a part of at all.
Well, because we have been distracted by this nightly telenovela. That's what I call the Rachel Maddow Show now, mm-hmm. where, you know, these astounding new dramatic developments occur. And there are interesting things going on. Paul Manafort and the schemes that he was running, trying to use his position on the Trump campaign to refinance his crumbling empire. Mm. And he and, Rick Gates, who took the guilty plea on Friday, and he's going to be singing some pretty interesting songs. But none of this relates to the original claims that Russia hacked the DNC and gave that to WikiLeaks to weaponize against Hillary Clinton and tilt the election in Trump's favor.
Exactly.
And most people are just carried, you know, on this wave of anti-Russian hysteria. And the late Bob Perry, who wrote so critically and skeptically at consortiumnews.com, really, you know, just on a daily basis was dismantling the myth-making and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, where is the evidence? Mm. And the media malpractice that we're seeing that enables the nation to be distracted by Trump's latest tweet, and we don't look at the very serious issues. I think people do pay attention to the confrontation with North Korea, which is dangerous as well. But they see us as the good guys and that we have no choice, right? We simply must disarm this madman. But we are the rogue nation.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with that. And that's a realization that is so hard to accept. You know, I don't want to be the bad guys, but in World War III, we are. And I just, it's so different from what I was told when I was a kid. I'm just kind of like, I'm just having trouble accepting all of it right now. I'm just because I was born in 1982, and so my textbooks were full of the American myths. And now when I watch what we're doing, I watch the hearings, I read the bills, I read the laws, it's just like, we're the scary ones. We're the ones creating these horrible weapons and passing them out all over the world. I mean, we're not even requiring that people pay for them. We are funding the government of Afghanistan's military. We're creating the military for the new government in Ukraine. And we're giving God only knows who weapons in Syria in an attempt to overthrow that government. And it's all there on C-SPAN every day. They talk about it openly, and it's in the laws, it's in the bills. I can't make this stuff up. And I mean, I guess I could, but I'm not. And I guess that's what's so shocking about it. It's all hidden in plain sight. Anybody can do what I'm doing, but they're not. Instead, they're focusing on, like you said, these indictments, which when you read the actual documents, it has nothing to do with what the investigation was supposed to be about. Those 13 people that were indicted, those they call them Russian nationals,
right.
But they're 13 private citizens of Russia that started a troll farm, spent a couple $1 million on tweets and Facebook ads.
Right.
I mean, this is not Pearl Harbor. And yet the Democrats are literally making that comparison. So it's just...
And this is where we come back to the risk of nuclear proliferation.
Yeah.
And the casual threats that are tossed about. And as you pointed out, Gerald Nadler, who is a humorless Democratic congressman from New York. I've interviewed him several times. Tried to get him to laugh once, and it was just useless. But with a straight face, he was telling Chris Hayes that this is just like Pearl Harbor. And even Hayes, who unfortunately has become part of the team stoking this whole Russiagate narrative, He reeled and said, well, gosh, nobody's died from Russiagate.
Yeah. Nobody. Isn't that a stretch?
Dropped bombs on a naval base.
Yeah.
And so this does, basically condition people to expect that, oh, yeah, war with Russia, we probably ought to do that.
Yeah, Russia's our enemy. They've always been our enemy, which in my lifetime, that's not true. I watched the Berlin Wall come down. I thought we were fine. We've been partnering with Russia and trying to dismantle our nuclear programs. I remember the 90s. You can't tell me it didn't happen. I was there. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that's so stunning to me, is it took almost nothing to get the American people to switch. And sometimes I think it's just the media and it's not the American people, but then I'm driving here and over the freeway overpass, there was a sign that said, follow the rubles. So, I mean, this idea is getting out there. People are buying it, and people on Twitter are getting angry with me for not taking this more seriously. And it's really depressing, because when you watch that anti-Russia line on the television and then you match that with what they're doing with our actual money, which is $1.2 trillion to replace our nuclear weapons infrastructure, you can see that that isn't justified unless we have a big bag nuclear armed enemy. Mm-hmm. So we need to have this enemy to justify that funding. And I think that's the real story here. I think you and I are the only people talking about it. And that's so depressing to me.
And Jen, let's just focus for a moment on the Democrats. In the summer of 16, the first, rumors or rumblings surfaced of a hack at the DNC. Mm-hmm. And then we very soon heard the intelligence community assert, without offering any evidence, that Russia was meddling in our election. And after Hillary lost, and I believe she should have won, I didn't support her, but I believe that the election was rigged against her through various voter suppression schemes that were successful, through a rigged count in Michigan that has been exposed, and other games that were played by Americans who interfered in our election, not offshore bots and humans and intelligence officers. Codename Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. I mean, I find that so cartoonish. it just cracks me up. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say the Democrats were right. Well, Barack Obama didn't declassify any information before he left office, which was well within his rights, that he could have used to really expose what they believe occurred, right? They didn't use the Electoral College. They didn't challenge state-level election counts. They didn't use the final canvas that was presented to the Senate in the first session of the 2017 year. At least when Bush stole Ohio in 2004, there were people who attempted to, at least for the record, blocked the certification of the election. So the Democrats made no effort to do that. And then they say, this is this crisis and he's, not a real president. And therefore, they're going to collude with the intelligence community and the FBI, two elements of our government that I have been critical of and skeptical of for 40 years now. And they're going to embrace this as the source of truth and vindication.
I know, right? It's disturbing. It's all disturbing. I mean, we kind of mentioned this before, but when I started paying attention to politics, it was during the George W. Bush administration. And so I was looking to them as the opposition party to expose what was going on and to be the antidote to that. And then here during the Trump administration, they're off the rails too, So it's like, even though there are very disturbing things going on with the Trump administration, I mean, just the fact that he's a real estate mogul and he hasn't given up any of his properties, and our government is putting people up in Trump hotels. I mean, there's an enormous amount of conflict of interest there. He's profiting off of our government. It's that's the type of stuff that I wish the Democrats would focus on if they really wanted to go after him. But then they might have to go after their own people who are filthy rich and have their own conflicts of interest. It just opens up a can of worms. Where this Russia stuff, it's a convenient enemy, because we know that they are just as complicit in the war machine as the Republicans are. And that's been the realization, I think, not just for me, but for my entire generation.
Well, in the recent budget debate, the Democrats were not in any way trying to trim the increases to Pentagon funding. They were arguing for parity with domestic programs.
Bingo.
And that was so telling. And here these people are so viscerally opposed to Trump. He's a cancer on the democracy that we cherish, right? Mm-hmm. And this is these are acts of war. But they just gave him $70 billion that the Pentagon didn't ask for in additional funding that essentially is a blank check for the next war.
Yeah.
And they rammed through the extension of the FISA law with zero amendments to protect Americans from massive domestic surveillance, which enables Trump to spy on Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, if only self-interest drives what they do, you would think they'd say, huh, maybe we should limit the use of FISA. You know, maybe we shouldn't allow this administration to have the kind of access that Obama had, because after all, he was always a good guy.
And I think that's what some of us were hoping for when this did happen. Like, maybe that would be the silver lining, that we would elect someone like Donald Trump and then someone would fight back and be like, whoa, maybe we've given the president too much power. Maybe we should start pulling back on those reins. The Democrats are doing the exact opposite. And it's so frustrating to watch. I mean, I don't know who we can even appeal to in Congress right now. I've wanted us to clean house for a while, but now I don't see any other solution to this, because both parties are just so complicit in all of it. The spying, the wars, all of it.
Well, I wish I could you know, pat you on the shoulder after you sign a non-harassment agreement and say, there, Jen, it's okay. I've been around longer and these things come and go. But this is a new state of affairs where it's not simply gridlock. It is a kind of lockdown behind the forces of money.
Yeah.
And the oligarchy that is embedded into the defense complex, and it is unlikely to change unless we fundamentally change campaign finance. And let me come back to the Democrats for a couple of more bites here, because they're really misleading the base. They've got everybody whipped up about Russia, 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 and they create the impression that Mueller and the Russia story are so powerful that it will vanquish Trump, that he will exit the scene. But Nancy Pelosi is opposed to impeachment. And you know the count from the December resolution from Al Green of Texas, where I believe there are 190-some Democrats in the House, and only 70 of them voted in favor of Al Green's impeachment resolution.
Yeah.
And the reason they were whipped against the measure.
Of course, because Trump is the best thing that ever happened for their campaign contributions, because they're just running against Trump. They're doing the same thing that Hillary did. They're running against him. Oh, isn't he awful? Oh, he tweeted this thing. Donate to us so we can win in the 2018 elections. I don't think that they're actually opposed to Trump. Otherwise, they wouldn't have given him expanded spying powers until at least halfway through his second term. That's when the next time we get the chance to let these things expire. And so they gave him more spying powers. And then there's also, this was weird. We've had all these continuing resolutions to fund our government, which I'm sure you have a very intelligent audience, but the government hasn't been funded correctly for 2018. We're sitting here in February and only war has been funded, but there's 11 other sections that haven't. And every time this continuing resolution gets signed, it's an opportunity to get something signed into law that wouldn't otherwise get signed.
Right. Must pass.
Must pass legislation. I call them dingleberries. They put all kinds of stuff on there and they just hitch their way into law.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed is, and it was either the second or third, there was a bunch of money for missile defense. It was about $4 billion specifically for missile defense. And I kind of tore that apart, tried to figure out where it was going. But then in the fourth continuing resolution, I'm losing track of which one's which,
mm-hmm.
but that $4 billion was allowed to be transferred to the intelligence community. And then the requirements that Congress be informed of what they're doing with it was completely eliminated for that $4 billion. And I know this because the head of the intelligence committee, Richard Burr, mm-hmm. who's not exactly someone who's fighting for our rights, he got up and said, this is a blank check. and they gave it to him, you know, and it was Democrats and Republicans. So if he's so dangerous, do you really want to give his spooks $4 billion that no one is going to know where that went to? You know, so it's stuff like that. And that's when Richard Burr gets on the floor of the Senate, it's in every single office. They all have C-SPAN on. They all could find out about this. They didn't care. And I'm watching all these hearings that are talking about nuclear weapons and how we're in it, barreling towards a nuclear war with Russia. The looks on their faces, it's like you're telling them that Cheerios are delicious. They're just like, there's no expression on their faces. And I'm here furious about it because they're playing with our lives. But nope, this is business as usual up there on the Hill. If anything, it's just going to help them raise campaign contributions. It's just another thing they get to email about. It's like a game to these people. And it's not a game to us.
Well, Jen, you mentioned these continuing resolutions, and the actual trigger that caused me to say I needed to talk to Jen Briney again was an email I got from John Zweibel. He's a retired tech guy. He lives in Hawaii, and he is a leftist Bernie-crat who is just so frustrated with, just like you are, with the way Congress operates. And he said, could I do a story about how so-called progressive groups harm their own cause when they fail to tell the complete story? As an example, this morning I received emails from Credo and the Progressive Democrats of America about Democratic members of Congress who failed to vote correctly on getting a Clean Dreamer bill passed before the end of 2017. The Credo petition was especially scathing. Neither group explained that H.R. 1370 was a CR, continuing resolution, meant to keep the government open. Neither group discussed the additional funding provided to keep the CHIP program funded through March 2018. So his point is that we are getting these kind of siloed, very targeted emails that tell us to support or oppose a specific bill that has so much in it that people can have a rational reason for voting for it.
Absolutely.
There are equal rational reasons for voting against it. But by reducing things to these narrow interest group politics against these massive aircraft carriers loaded with dingleberries, as you call it, it does really complicate the picture. And it can send people in directions where they're either chasing their own tail or eating it off.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually a really good example of that dynamic happening, that continuing resolution, because that's the one that actually did result in a shutdown. And there was nothing in that continuing resolution that the Democrats were actually against. Like he said, there was funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, which they had been screaming about for a long time, rightfully. And it was in that continuing resolution. What the Democrats wanted is they wanted something attached that would help the Dreamers. What was frustrating to me, they didn't tell us what that something was. We didn't actually have a bill that we could read that they were demanding. They just, we have to do something. And so they were having the negotiations while the clock was ticking. If that continuing resolution didn't become law, we shut down the government, which is exactly what happened. But it's the same exact strategy that the Republicans employed in 2013 that made us all so mad. The Republicans wanted something attached, and there were a bunch of different options that they tried, but they wanted something attached that would dismantle the Affordable Care Act. And until they got that, they were not going to vote for the continuing resolution. Same exact dynamics. The Democrats tried the same thing with the Dreamers, but they were even less effective because they didn't have a bill. You know, like, if you want to do something, at least tell us what the something is. And so that's why the government shut down. Mm-hmm. And then I also got, I'm still getting feedback for this, but I was also upset because the next morning, the people that you would think are the Democrats' allies, the people that marched in the Women's March, that was the day of the Women's March. So you wake up that morning, you're going out marching anyway. The government has just shut down because the Democrats are going all out, for better or worse. They're going all out to do something for the Dreamers. And yet their allies are marching in the streets and, like, not talking about the Dreamers, completely unaware of the government shutting down. There were no signs at all saying reopen our government or anything. It just was completely disconnected from what was going on in government. So what I'm watching is that my fellow Americans don't know what's going on in their government, even when they're out in the streets. It's completely disconnected from what was going on that very day. And so if people wanted something done for the Dreamers, they sure didn't show the Democrats that, and the Democrats caved. And I personally think the cave is a good thing because it reopened our government.
Well, I take your point regarding the lack of an actual bill about the Dreamers, but I regard them as hostages, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was Trump who put them in that category.
Yes.
But the Democrats have responded in kind by using the Dreamers as a bargaining chip.
Yes.
And I did initially support their effort to link the budget to getting relief for Dreamers and a new DACA bill. But your point is excellent. But the other part of this is that after the 60-hour shutdown, Schumer, who, you know, cannot walk away from a television camera, made an offhand comment that I thought was quite revealing. He said, well, just wait until March 6th. That's the expiration of Trump's six-month hold on it. And they start deporting Dreamers. So he was actually almost frothing at the mouth at the prospect that there will be headlines and negative reporting when Dreamers are deported. And this seemed to strengthen his resolve to disconnect the budget issues from DACA, and that essentially left the Democrats without any other leverage. And and so they have ended up essentially accepting, and they got a lot of goodies for Democrats and for their interest groups in the final bill that was rammed through, but at the expense of the Dreamers. And as we're speaking today on the last Monday in February, the Supreme Court has declined to intervene, and so a lower court ruling that the Obama policy, more or less, will remain in place. Now it just removes the hostage label, at least temporarily. And now I don't think anything will get done.
Yeah, maybe. And the thing is, like, I do understand the Democrats' decision to make that play, because as the minority party, it's the only play they have. If they don't have the votes in either chamber, which they don't, they have to legislate by dingleberry. It's the only choice they have. So I understand it. I mean, I understand it. It's the only thing they can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, I honestly believe that they do care. What bothers me is that the people that are saying that they want to help the Democrats and they're anti all of the stuff that Trump is doing, including deporting people, the people are not supporting the Democrats. They're not aware of what's going on. So if the Democrats are going to make these desperate plays, one of the reasons Schumer makes a comment like that is because he needs the people to stand up and call and march and do all these things to show the support for the Democrats, to get the, you know, the weasel Democrats to get on board. There's a lot of them that just, they don't care. They're there for the money. But you need to pressure those people. And as long as we're marching in the streets for no particular reason and not actually helping the Democrats in the things they're going to do, we're not helping them even in these few instances where they are trying to help people like you and I. You know, it's, I don't know what we do about that.
Yeah.
I don't know what we do.
Well, and, you know, we are already, you know, heading into the primary cycle here for the midterm elections. And the Democrats, as you pointed out a few minutes ago, are using the same tired saw. Hey, look at the Republicans. We're not as bad.
Mm-hmm.
We don't suck as bad as they do.
Yeah.
So give us control of the House, and maybe we can eke out either even Steven or a one-seat majority in the Senate. And both of those would be better than what we have right now. But if you're going to populate the House with these conservative Democrats, the kind of people who gave Pelosi the speakership back in 2006, it really doesn't make much difference.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the Republicans have completely sold out to corporate interests, but we've only sold out at 80%, so vote for us. And that's really what they're running on. It's, yeah, there's a few issues that they're better on, but the ones that really matter to me when it comes to corporatism and war, and they're pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George W. Bush, he overturned the governments in Afghanistan and Iraq. Obama did Ukraine and Libya, tried to do Syria. I mean, he tried to go further than W. Bush. Like, who do we look to? Unless we start looking to other parties and just individuals, because the Democrats are not the answer. The only thing that I would like to see, I'd like the Democrats to get at least one of the houses back if only for the investigation purposes. Because right now, nothing is being investigated. And at the end of the W. Bush administration, we did get some good answers from people like Pat Leahy. He had a good committee. I think he was the Senate Judiciary Committee. We got some good information about what was going on there. And so if they they do better investigations, especially if the administration is a Republican one. So I would like to at least see that dynamic set up. But yeah, they're just running on the same tired script as Hillary.
Well, they should not Trump.
Well,
and your point there about oversight is critical.
Yeah.
And we've had an intentional failure of oversight. I think the Oversight Committee should be renamed the Overlook Committee.
Yeah.
And you bring issues before us and we'll overlook them.
Absolutely.
Rubber stamp it. Give you more money. Promote your leaders.
The best example of that is the intelligence committees that are supposed to be overseeing what happens in the intelligence community. And really, they just serve to keep that information secret from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most frustrating thing in the world. Dianne Feinstein. Do you see the Democrats did not endorse her?
I was going to bring that up. So, you know, people listen all over the country and some offshore. Here in California over the weekend, the state party had its convention. And Dianne Feinstein, who is running for a sixth term.
Something like that, yeah. She's been in my entire lifetime.
Right, yeah.
So.
Well, not actually. She was elected in 92.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know it seems like she's been there since you were born.
Oh, okay. That actually makes me feel a little bit better.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. In 1992, I moderated debates. We had both Senate seats open at the same time. Because Pete Wilson had resigned to be elected governor.
Oh, and she then got Pete Wilson's Senate seat.
She got Wilson's, and Boxer got the other one.
Okay. That is coming back to me now. Okay.
So we're staging these debates at Channel 5 in San Francisco, and Feinstein is really upset with me because there was a minor party candidate who we had excluded from the debate. Joe Alioto of San Francisco, not the former mayor, but his son. And he had no campaign, he had no money, he wasn't showing up in the polls. And in order to make the debate work without having 19 people on the stage, we had set up guidelines. So right before the debate, I escorted her husband up to the green room where she was, and she looked at me and she said, "You're the monster who's keeping Joe Alioto out of this debate." Well, the reason she wanted Joe there is that she ended up on the set alone with Gray Davis, who was running against her for that Senate seat in the primary. And she hated Gray Davis because he had run a campaign ad where he put Dianne Feinstein's picture on a milk carton and said, "Well, she's missing."
Oh, no.
We haven't seen her in ages. And so it was just very petty, personal stuff. And that epitomizes Feinstein.
Yeah.
She is very detail-oriented. And she famously said about the way she treats her staff, she said, "I don't get ulcers. I give them." So anyway, over the weekend, Feinstein, who announced that she will run for re-election, sought the endorsement of the Democratic State
Party. At age 85.
Right. And Kevin DeLeon, who is the current leader of the state Senate, he's from Los Angeles. He's nominally progressive, but he's taken a lot of corporate campaign money in the state legislature, and we can expect him to do the same in his Senate race. But he is certainly running to her left. He's younger, and you know, he's got a lot of good selling points. There's also a third guy named Pat Harris, who, like I excluded Joe Alioto, is being not only cut out of the party activities, he got 5% in the endorsement race, but the media doesn't even mention him.
Yeah, I've never heard of him.
There's an article in the Chronicle today where it shows that he got 5% of the delegate votes, but the body copy of the story doesn't even mention who he is or how he did it. And so we have media that filters these races. There's also a bright young woman, and I'm sorry, I can't think of her name.
Allison Hartley?
Yeah. She's connected to the Young Turks.
Yes.
And she didn't get any coverage at all.
Yeah.
At the state party convention. So the media are doing their job of, you know, eliminating what they see as extreme candidates, fringe candidates, when, in a case like Feinstein, this should be a wide open race. And whoever wants to jump in fact, you know, the more candidates in the race, the lower the threshold to reach the top two of being on the ballot against her in November. So it's very interesting the way all this ties together, that the money that funds campaigns also funds advertising in newspapers. And the newspaper owners identify with corporate entities more than the general public now.
Of course.
And so we see them screen out people who decide to run for office.
Run for office and do so without collecting enormous amounts of money.
Yeah. Pat Harris, the biggest difference between him and De Leon is that he's not accepting any corporate money.
Exactly. And I keep thinking, I have a friend that's running for Congress, Jessica Morse, in the 4th District of California. And so I asked her, I said, Jessica, where does the money go? And she said the vast majority of it has to go to the television ads. They wanted like $700,000 for a spot. That's an enormous amount of money. So if you think about that, all of the money that's going into our elections, the vast majority of it is then being funneled into the media. So these candidates are their customers. You know, it's these candidates they need to please. It's not us. And that's not what the Fourth Estate's supposed to do. They're supposed to behave like you and I.
And during campaigns, television news doesn't cover political campaigns. They just let the TV spots run in between stories about murder and corruption or, you know, whatever they happen to be covering that night.
Yeah, there's no education happening.
Yeah.
It's a real shame. But with Dianne Feinstein, I mean, I think it's kind of fascinating how few votes she got. I believe it was 57 to 34. They voted for another guy. So they didn't officially endorse the other guy just because he had to get 60, I believe.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But we have a top two primary. It's not impossible that she doesn't make the top two, which would make me so happy.
There was also just an optical failure by Dianne's team. And Bill Carrick is her lead consultant. But she was given a certain amount of time to address the convention. And maybe they applauded so much her early comments that it delayed her speech. But she got the boot. They started to play music, like just like in an award show. And so at a certain point, Dianne just said, "Well, I guess my time's up."
You bet it is, girlfriend.
And that is the soundbite that is going to lead commercials for her opponent later this year.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my time is up.
Oh, that's good. That's good. But I'm proud of them for playing the music. You know, Queen Dianne, you're just a candidate. You don't own the seat. And why do people think that they get the seat until they die? You know, why does she feel that at 85 years old, she should be making the rules for my generation and the generations younger me? You know, like, I hate to be ageist, but I'm going to be. Her time is up, you know? She's from a different generation. I feel like if you're going to make the rules that we have to live by in the internet age, you should be in the internet age. We don't need someone who's 91 years old making the rules for the tech community. You know, it's just, I'm so tired of it. It's these people that are... The governing of the internet is one of the things I think is most important right now, which is why I really do think we need some new blood in there that really understand it. Because one of the connections I made in one of my last few episodes, getting back to the Russia stuff, but I am convinced that one of the reasons we're being told that social media posts and Facebook ads are an act of war is because this is how they're going to get us to support measures to censor the internet.
Yeah.
These people have been controlling the messages through TV and newspapers forever. And this was the year that Hillary lost because we were able to talk to each other. And they are terrified of that. And so these are not people that I want controlling the internet in any way. We still haven't written the rules for the internet. And what they're trying to do is to get companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google to take posts down and to take people off of the internet. And it's happening.
Well, and we know that Google has adjusted its algorithms, the traffic, search traffic to the World Socialist website, Consortium News, Truth Out, Truth Dig.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen my traffic decline as well. And you know, you look at the analytics of your site, we get explicit information about where a referral came from.
Yeah.
And the number of referrals I get from Google has dropped measurably.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's accidental. I try not to be too paranoid and, you know.
I know it's not. I saw it in a hearing. I know it's not accidental.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing is they want to combat fake news. What they're doing is they're saying that real news comes from the Washington Post and the New York Times and USA Today and these major publications where these government officials have been able to forever get their messages out. And so what they're saying is, well, we don't want you getting fake news. And so they put these things at the top because that's the real news. And then everybody else, you know, you'll fit in where you will. But yeah, this happening on purpose, and they're saying it out loud to Congress, and Congress is cheering it on. That's not representing me. That's representing themselves.
Jen, I want to strongly recommend your two most recent podcasts, and you number yours, number 168 and number 167 at congressionaldish.com, because you have done an excellent job of, as I describe it, forensically figuring out the U.S. posture toward Ukraine and the proxy war that we're running. It's not really getting major coverage, but it does occur on a daily basis. And I'm one of those outliers who believes that the U.S. had an outsized role in the 2014 coup that took out Yanukovych. And of course, because, number one, there are no clean people in Ukraine, okay? He locked up his main challenger, the beautiful blonde Tymoshenko. And before that, we had another corrupt ruler of Ukraine. So there aren't any good guys here. But Yanukovych was the elected leader of Ukraine, and the U.S. Worked with different proxy groups, with USAID, turning a blind eye to neo-Nazi groups that were active in the Maidan Revolution there in Ukraine. And so you came to a conclusion, really, by following the money about the U.S. role in Ukraine. Help our listeners understand that.
Well, yeah. So what I've been tracing is that when that coup happened, if you look at the timeline, so there were protesters that were going against their government. I mean, it really came down to a trade agreement. So what was happening is that Ukraine was going to partner with Europe, mm-hmm. and they were supposed to sign this big trade agreement. This, I think, was November of 2013. And right before they were supposed to sign it, which, you know, Ukraine needed some money. The International Monetary Fund, their game is that they go to countries and they say, we'll give you the money that you need. In this case, it was $15 billion. But you need to change your economic laws to match the world trade system, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Open your markets to American companies, bust your unions.
Yes, and
it's Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. Yes,
it is. So they specifically wanted that gas industry because Ukraine has a lot of natural gas underneath their soil that hasn't been fracked yet. So that's what the multinationals really want out of Ukraine. And so the IMF had offered them $15 billion with all kinds of strings. Well, Ukraine is next door to Russia, and Russia is where Ukraine gets most of its gas because, like I said, they haven't fracked their own, so they still have to import it to heat their homes, and Ukraine can be quite cold. And so so Russia, they didn't like the fact that Ukraine was going to partner with Europe, and so they offered Ukraine a $15 billion stringless loan and a discount in the natural gas, which was a big deal. And so right at the last minute, Ukraine pulled out of the deal with the EU and instead said, we're going to partner with our next-door neighbor, Russia.
And let me take a quick time out here.
Sure.
Because after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the U.S. Agreed that if Ukraine denuclearized, we would come to its defense.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do that. Instead, we helped foment a coup. And historically, you know, again, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we worked very hard to isolate Russia by expanding NATO to include former Soviet republics.
Yeah.
And Ukraine
is right up to Russia's border.
And Ukraine is where Moscow drew the line and said, no, that naval base in Sevastopol is too important to us.
Down in Crimea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
it houses their Black Sea fleet. It's pretty big.
Right.
It's pretty big.
And so even if you find this, you know, legally and morally offensive that Russia took back Crimea, essentially.
Well, you're getting ahead of the story because the government got overturned first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of how it was done. I mean, the details are still fuzzy, but we know that Senator John McCain, Republican, along with Chris Murphy, Democrat, went in December of 2013, spoke to the protesters and said, "Your future lies with Europe." And then there was Secretary of State, the Deputy Secretary of State of, I think, Near Eastern Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
I get them mixed up. But right. Victoria Nuland is her name.
Sure.
She was caught with the ambassador to Ukraine planning who would go into the future government. And the thing about that phone call is you hear it, and the people that they said would be the heads of state, mm-hmm. they were.
The Candyman.
Yeah, Yats is what they call him. Yatsenyuk. Arseny Yatsenyuk. But she calls him Yats, because mm-hmm. apparently they're buddies like that.
Yeah.
So she gets caught. We hear that. That government did come into being, and they immediately signed the trade deal with Europe. And so if you look at it from Russia's perspective, here they had a government that was going to partner with them economically, which is now suddenly thrown out. They heard the same call I did. They know that we were mm-hmm. involved somehow. And Crimea is a part of Ukraine, but Russia was leasing that land for the military base that houses their Black Sea Fleet. So what did they do? They went in there. They took over the peninsula that houses their military. And what also kind of blows me away is Crimea was Russian until 1954.
Right.
So in 1954, it was given over to Ukraine voluntarily. Russia took it back. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I get it. I get it.
Right. You're
a
realist.
This is a hostile government that was just installed in very shady ways.
And the only little detail I would add is that Joe Biden's son was appointed by Yanukovych to the board of the energy.
Yanukovych or Yatsenyuk?
No, it was Yanukovych.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the guy we overthrew appointed Joe Biden's kid.
Yes.
That's weird.
It was. It was weird.
And the other thing I noticed in the Manafort indictment, he is accused of having a relationship with that government.
Oh, yeah.
A financial relationship with the government that we
overthrew. Right.
Yeah.
No, he was Yanukovych's guy. And it does appear, my theory here, and I'm speculating based on this indictment and what we've seen so far, is that Manafort was just a con man who was able to get millions from Yanukovych, also from the oligarch Deripaska, because at the center of his financial crisis is that he had a judgment that Deripaska had won for $8 million that he had to scramble to repay. And so Manafort clearly is, I think, going up the river. He was deeply compromised. But again, it still doesn't link us to the foundational claims of Russian interference in our election.
Yeah, that was stunning. It really had nothing to do with that. I mean, if you just look at Manafort and that whole, they just seem like greedy people to me. You just found greedy people. And yeah, he worked for the Trump campaign. And what I saw was the media freaking out about it. They were just like, he was committing crimes while working for Trump. Well, the crime was tax evasion. You know, it had nothing to do with rigging an election. It was tax evasion. The guy was taking millions of dollars, didn't want to pay taxes. And yeah, those timelines overlapped, but had nothing to do with the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read these documents, whether it's the troll farm or Manafort, but you read what they're actually finding, there's no there so far.
Yeah.
You know, this election was lost by Hillary Clinton. But like you said, there are so many domestic things that might have flipped that election. Cross-check, where they're just throwing people off the voter rolls because mm-hmm. they have similar names. I mean, Black people in this country were brought here as slaves, and they were named after their owners. I know plenty of Black people whose last names are all Jackson or Johnson. You know, so it's if you take all of these similar names and cross them off the list, you get a lot of people that should have been able to vote that couldn't.
Yeah.
And that was happening all over the country.
Indeed.
That's domestic election interference, and that's real. That stops votes. But Facebook ads, like who votes based on Facebook ads? Also, the fact that they're calling it an essential part of our process. Pretty sure Facebook wasn't even a thing 20 years ago. So how is it now an essential part of our process?
The other thing that I'm waiting to see is somebody who analyzes the overlap between people who use Twitter and people who vote, including the subset of people who voted for Trump. Because I don't believe that Twitter has that much impact in its own universe. It's when people report tweets in other media that the general public becomes aware. But, you know, the average Trump voter, I don't believe, was looking at Twitter and waiting for the latest divisive message to come from St. Petersburg.
Well, yeah, that just, it shows an ignorance into how Twitter works, because Twitter's my favorite social media. I use it all the time. But I follow specific people. So if there's a bot, you know, I'm not following it. I'm not trusting that information. Maybe if someone I follow retweets it, I might see it. But there's so much stuff that I see as I'm scrolling. And with the amount of money, had they spent $1 billion, maybe I could see that getting out to the level that they're claiming. But they spent $1 or $2 million. I believe what I saw was $1.2 million, but then they also hired people. I don't know. But it's just, that's not how Twitter works. If you don't follow the bots, you're not going to see their tweets.
David Brock was running a troll farm for Hillary. And
yes,
correct the record.
That's true.
Trump and his his media advisor, I think it's Brad Parscale, they spent $80 million on Facebook ads alone, and they were darkly targeted. And so I would prefer to believe, and I think evidence would bear this out, that Parscale's targeting, and they were doing a lot of work where Facebook teams were in the offices with the Trump campaign. And so that level of collusion between Facebook and a campaign, and they did offer it to the Clinton campaign, which declined. So, you know, we'll leave that where it is there. But still, you know, Trump did very effectively game social media, got all the free mainstream media coverage just by being outrageous all the time. And people overlook that and say, you know, these 13 guys in St. Petersburg, they're the real culprits here.
And if you watch hearings, as I do, it actually was not in any of these Russia episodes. It's my net neutrality episode. At the end of that, I watched a hearing with Facebook and Twitter and Google, and we were told the Facebook ads, there was like $100,000.
Yeah.
Compared to these millions and millions and millions of dollars.
45% of it ran before the election. You know, so you're talking $45,000.
Yeah.
And it's trivial.
It's a drop in the bucket.
And when we see smart people exaggerate that and make it seem like it really was a major threat, I just lose all respect for those people.
Yeah, we're being manipulated for some reason. And I think it's so that we'll support internet censorship, because I'm seeing it happen.
Yeah.
Where people are like, yeah, we need to take down these posts because we have to protect our electoral process, don't you know? And it's like, that's not how you do it. But people are defending, you know, the Facebook path. I think if this storyline hadn't been amplified the way it is, and now that you're seeing people being taken off of Twitter entirely, or seeing people's YouTube channels being taken off entirely or being demonetized. I mean, we're watching this happen in real time. I think there would be a much larger backlash to it than is happening right now. But as it's happening, we're being told that it's to protect our election process. And here in the United States, I honestly believe that the vast majority of us, I don't think most of us realize how we're not a democracy anymore. But we want to think we are, and our elections do matter to us. We don't want anyone tampering with those. And so it's a really smart strategy they're employing to get us to support internet censorship. It's working. But I don't see any other reason for this particular storyline to be amplified. Because like you said, as soon as you break it down, it just falls apart. It's a drop in the bucket. It's not this serious. So there's a reason they need us to think that it is. And I'm convinced the internet censorship. Internet censorship is it.
Mm-hmm. Jen, as we wrap up, I want to commend you, because in your episode 168, I was wowed by the clips that you included from Dr. Henry A. Kissinger.
Yeah.
And you also, and this is a compliment, you've exposed to your age. And given that you were born well after Kissinger was in office and his reign of terror ended, I really appreciate that you understand his outsized role in American foreign policy, not just in the Nixon administration, but since the Nixon administration. And he was regularly talking with Obama during his 8 years in office.
Well, Donald Trump just had a sit down with him a couple weeks ago. Just the two of them.
And you, because you are obsessed with watching C-SPAN, bless you, you saw this testimony where Kissinger and George Shultz, who had been Secretary of State during the Nixon administration, both testified. And Kissinger's worldview is terrifying Tell our listeners some of the quotes that you included.
Well, one of the things that was stunning to me is that Kissinger said straight up that their world order is failing. And this, I mean, the theory that I'm running on.
Systemic failure of the world order.
I know. He just sounds like a supervillain with that voice. And he pauses for really long amounts of time. So my poor editor had to go and take out some of the pauses just to make him listenable. It's so hard to listen to him. But when you speed it up, it's a lot better. But yeah, this guy, he was saying that the world order is failing. Because after World War II, the idea that I'm seeing being the big picture is that there was this economic system that the whole world is supposed to participate in, with the idea being that if we're all trading together, then we're never going to fight again. And so even if we have to kill a lot of people in the process to make this dream happen, which we have, once it's all done, once everyone is controlled by this one system, there will be peace. And he's been pushing this since World War II. And that is why we have our military in 180 countries. We are the muscle for this economic system. So to hear Henry Kissinger, of all people, say our system is failing, that tells me that they have two choices. They can either accept that, create a new system that's fair and that we don't need to kill people to implement, or they can double down. And what I'm seeing is that they're doubling down, and that the nuclear stuff, the nuclear weapon stuff, is at the center of that, because they need the whole world to be afraid of us. They keep calling it deterrence, but the whole world needs to be terrified of the United States, because this world order is failing. We need to get it back on track. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the main message of Kissinger. But it was just the thing that's sticking with me is that he said that the world order is failing. ISIS has been defeated, and that the new, it's basically the Cold War is back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really big, really big switch that we're seeing happening in the halls of Congress right now.
Well, Jen, I really value what you do. I want to thank you for paying attention, for following facts.
Oh, thank you.
And not just, you know, media hype and consensus narratives. And I just want to encourage you to keep doing this. I really try to connect with younger people who are doing valuable work. And, you know, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing for a while, but I hit 65 this year, and I'm going to be dialing back, and eventually I'm going to disappear from the scene here. And I feel more confident knowing that people like you are taking on this kind of work, and you've got the right focus, you have the right ethical base. I just hope that you don't get so discouraged by each encounter with the buzzsaw when you watch another hearing or you break down another, you know, congressional budget document, because what you do is really valuable, and it's more important than ever as we see the mainstream media checking out.
Oh, thank you. And I'm just having a bad day. It's been a lot of war for the last month, and I have one more bill to get through because, like I said, they only funded war for the last continuing resolution. So I have that ahead of me, and I think that's why I'm feeling like this right now. Mm-hmm. It gets better.
Yeah, it'll get better when you get to the EPA. And
oh, man. And that's it, too. All the news is bad right now. And so to focus on it this intensely, but it has to get better. It has to, doesn't it?
Yes.
Eventually, maybe. I don't know. So, yeah, I'm going to keep trying as long as I can handle it.
Jennifer Briney, support her work at congressionaldish.com.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Jennifer Briney of Congressional Dish. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.